Shalom, Boker Tov from Israel. It is now Sunday, October 29th, 2023. It is Yud Daled of Cheshvan, the 14th of Cheshvan, the Hebrew month of Cheshvan, in the year of Tavshin Pei Daled, 5784. Welcome to Awakening Torah, Musar, Mindfulness. I'm Rabbi Chassia Uriel Steinbauer, the founder and director of the Institute for Holiness, Hamakom leKedusha, Machon, Kehilat Musar Mindfulness. We are a community worldwide that are made up of people on the path of Musar Mindfulness, where we commit to being practitioners, taking refuge in the path together, in community and God, in service to others. And I'm delighted that you've joined us. We are going to cover yesterday's Torah portion, Lech Lecha, in the book of Genesis, Bereshit. Yesterday was Yud Gimel of the Hebrew month of Cheshvan, the 13th, on October 28th, where we read in synagogues and minyanim across the world, Lech Lecha. So thank you for joining us. Before we begin, we always cover our kavanot, our intentions for today. So you might recall, if you joined us for Bereshit and Noach, that we are dedicating this year to a practice around grief and loss and the healing process because of the genocide that has taken place on October 7th on Shemini Atzeret and Simchat Torah here in Israel, and the ongoing still lack of identification of all the bodies and just having the dead still lie before us. Great suffering, trauma, and also that we have, last count, 229 people of our nation who have been kidnapped and are captives in Gaza by Palestinian terrorists. I don't only say Hamas because we know that there is Islamic Jihad and other forces usually supported by Iran there. So these are our kavanot. If you have vision and you can see and you're watching the video, we see this time together of doing awakening as an act of radical self-care, which is so important for any spiritual discipline, but especially in times of responding to great pain and trauma, that your practice has to be there like a cradle to hold you, for you to practice, to care for yourself, to be able to care for others. So we say that we're doing this time together here now on Awakening, which of course you're able to join us live stream right now on our YouTube channel. Please subscribe on the website, on the blog, either audio or video, but also on social media and then later on in recording. So we're doing this to strengthen our own soul in order to be of benefit to others in the future. We're also doing this time together to strengthen our relationship to others so that we can be a better conduit of God's good to others when they need us, which is so important right now. So many people are in need, including ourselves. So we have to have that wonderful triangle, the threefold, right? Care for the self, care for other, and our relationship with God. Turning to the Almighty to get help and strength and to strengthen each other. So the last kavanah, the last intention, is to strengthen our relationship with God, who I will call Hashem, in Hebrew meaning the name. So this is something I'm doing to strengthen my relationship with the Creator so that we can be a better conduit of God's good to others when they need us. So may we merit this today, tomorrow, and on going forward, to be on this path of healing, supporting each other, and move from here. Okay, so I'm stopping to share a screen. If you have vision and are watching on video, if you're listening on audio, I've removed what was up on the screen. So just as a disclaimer, you will notice that I feel that there's almost like tears behind my eyes. Very sad, very emotional, really relying on my practice and community to get me through day by day. You know, when people ask, how am I doing as the founder and director of the Institute for Holiness? I like to use that image where it says, I am broken, but the word okay is inside, because O and K are in the word broken. And that's how I feel. I feel broken. And I say, I'm okay, meaning I'm safe right now. Bezrat Hashem, thank God. But I don't feel okay. None of us do. None of us do. And to acknowledge that, right? To honor that. This is so much part of the practice that we're even going to hone in on today, is how do we practice self-compassion? How do we get through this minute by minute when we're still so much in it? Like people think, okay, you know, the people Israel are going to have, you know, more post-traumatic stress disorder as part of communal and transgenerational trauma passed on from thousands and thousands of years of kidnapping, genocide, trauma. But we're in it right now. We're in the stimuli still. Why? Because as I said, we have the dead still lying before us. Not everyone's buried or accounted for. We have those who are kidnapped that we are up all night worrying about, trying to bring home. It is the greatest mitzvah, the greatest commandment, to bring home a captive. And we're at war. We are at war. With Hamas, with terrorist groups in Gaza right now, even having activity with Hezbollah in the north, having activity with another terrorist group in the south. So this is it. This is a war against humanity. And if anything, this is a great independence war, maybe all over again, but obviously for new. So this is going to require radical self-care to be able to get through this. So let's jump in. What do we do here at Awakening? If you're new to us, welcome. If you're returning, welcome. Please subscribe. Please become join a subscription to on the website, to kehilatmusar.com, to receive the newsletter. And please join us. Become a member. Reach out, see how you can join a VAD, a Musar group, like a Sangha, where we practice Musar mindfulness together. Okay, so in this week's Torah portion, Lech Lecha, God commands Avram. His name is Avram before it becomes Avraham, okay? Avram to go from his land, his birthplace, and his father's house, right? To go from his home to the land that God will show him. Very profound. We will touch on that in a little bit. Avram and Sarai, she is also Sarai before she is Sarah. Both of them get name changes, which is a part of the Jewish tradition. When someone goes through something major, they often get a name change or they'll take one on. So Avram and Sarah, Sarai travel to Eretz Canaan, which is part of modern-day Israel, together with their nephew, sometimes called cousin, Lot. Okay, in English they'll say Lot, okay? And Avram and Lot each have their own large herds of cattle, and their shepherds begin to argue, and so they decide to split up. Lot goes on to Sodom, and Avram stays where he is. Before this even all happens, which is a quick summary, there's a famine in the land, and Avram and Sarai head down to Egypt to procure food and survive the famine. There she is the first Jew, the first Ivrit, the first Hebrew to be kidnapped, to be taken as captive by those who work in Pharaoh's court and Paro. And you know, there ends up being, well, we'll discuss it more clearly, but how does she end up being freed, right? And then we move on to the second story, which is when Lot moves to Sodom, there ends up being a war between five kings and four kings, and he ends up being kidnapped and taken captive. So this is the second recorded in the Torah. And this time Avram actually gathers an army and heads up north to redeem Lot and his family. And he fights. It's the first recorded war battle in the Torah, in the Hebrew Bible. A lot going on in this parsha, a lot that applies to today. Okay, so we need to look at that and consider it. So as I said, the four kings end up winning this war, and they conquered Sodom and taking Lot captive, as I told you. And then Avram chases down the four kings, defeats their armies, and rescues Lot. Okay. Then God makes a special promise to Avram, and that he will have children as numerous as the stars in the sky. Also later, as the dust, kind of the dirt and dust on the ground, and that they will inherit Eretz Canaan. Sarai has this whole time been wanting to become pregnant. We'll touch on this also. And she's barren. She hasn't been able to. So she has her servant, Hagar, marry Avram in order for a child to come from that union. And Hagar and Avram have a son named Yishmael. There's a lot that happens within that also. Okay, a lot of stimuli, a lot of reactivity we will look at. And then we also have to look at our own reactivity in response to what happens in this parsha. Okay, this is all part of the practice. So God changes Avram's name to Avraham, gives him the mitzvah of Brit Milah, of circumcision, for all Jewish baby boys from age 8 days, for this to occur. God also changes Sarai's name to Sarah, and says that this Brit, this covenant, will continue through her own son, Yitzhak, who will be born later. A lot of trust, bitachon, trust in God that all this will unfold, because if you follow this along, there's so much obstacles and trauma and difficulty and years of being childless that we're going to see a full human side to people who are just pushed to the brim. Their bucket is full. And then our own judgment, right? On top of that. So what are we looking at? I have so much I want to cover, but I don't want to take hours with you. I want to point out just very quickly that we're already starting to see, if we're going to cover grief and loss as our theme and trauma, essentially, over this year together for all the parashiyot, then we have to realize that there's already a theme that has emerged from Bereshit all the way now to Bereshit, Noach, and Lech Lecha, right? These three Torah portions, parashiyot. Okay, in the Dharma, in the mindfulness tradition, there are something called inarguables. You can't argue with them. It doesn't mean the human won't try, right? But the inarguables are, we're all born. We all will experience pain and suffering on some level. We'll all get sick. We'll all have issues in life. And we'll all die. Okay, those are the inarguables. You can try to fight them. You can try to be in denial from them. You can try, you know, over-identify. You can go through all the hindrances to try not to deal with one or more of these, usually the middle one and the last one. So listen, we were created, we were born in the Torah, right? And you witness already that people will experience suffering, and then they'll have their further reactivity, which will just only compound the suffering, right? So look what happens from the beginning of time in the Torah, right? we have Adam and Chava hiding. Hiding in response to lying, hiding in response to taking from the tree, which really has more to do about the relationship with God, that God has set up parameters in that relationship. In order to be in healthy relationship together, God has said, don't eat from this tree. They don't respect those boundaries and parameters. They know about it. They feel shame. They hide. Everyone makes it about being shameful that they're naked. I do not believe that has anything to do with it at all. It has to do with realizing that you have messed up, right? You have hurt this relationship. You are hiding from responsibility, from consequence. So this is the full catastrophe living, right? So this is the first. We have what I would call personal suffering, personal trauma that moves into familial, like of the family. Then we will notice that it moves into communal of the community, and then it moves into worldwide trauma. This is the pattern of the Torah. So what? Watch what happens. Adam and Chava are hiding. And then next is their son, Cain. Murder. It's the first recorded murder in the Torah. Murders his own brother. You know, it's debatable whether or not that was his kavanah, his intention. He might not even know what murder was, or that what he did was essentially going to take his brother's life. You know, it could have been involuntary manslaughter in some ways. We don't know, but we do know he doesn't accept the consequences of his behavior. He too also hides, with famously the first answering a question with a question. Am I my brother's keeper? When God says, what have you done to your brother? I hear his blood crying out from the ground. He says, am I my brother's keeper, right? Evading responsibility. Excuse me. So this has already moved from the personal of Adam and Chava into deeper into the family now. And then 10 generations of behavior like this before Noah, and it's now moved on to worldwide suffering and trauma because the lack of responsibility and just violence across the land. So there's the great flood. Everyone is taken except for Noah and his family. We start again back to the personal. What happens the minute Noah gets off the boat? Of course, he tries to go on with his life. You can imagine surviving something of the flood would be greatly traumatic. There would probably also be survivor guilt. Be very difficult for everyone involved. So you have to realize that the people who have survived that are carrying with them now a communal trauma, and eventually will become transgenerational trauma. Okay. So Noah, you know, even passes out, gets drunk. Whether that again was done with intention, who knows? Ham, one of his sons, dishonors him, shows him no dignity for his elderly father, exposes his nakedness, which is really back then. I mean, even today it would be horrific, but back then it's just considered a great, great sin. And so we've already moved from the personal into the family suffering and trauma. And then we move into Bavel, right? The Tower of Bavel, Migdal Bavel, which the people are really just misaligned, misinformed. There's greed based on fear, right? Fear that what happened during the flood is going to happen again. These people want to organize. They want to be guarded, get up to the sky, make a name for themselves, fearful that they're going to be wiped from the earth again. Again, this is all kind of reactivity from the trauma and that being passed on. So now we've moved to the communal level. And what is the response? God causes everyone to spread out from the earth. Okay, so now we've moved on to worldwide reactivity to this. And 10 generations later, now we have Avram appear on the picture, back to the personal and assumed familial. And this is where we're going to land. Okay. There's so much that happens here. Listen, the first I want to say is we've decided this year to really notice what judgment we have towards our ancestors and towards events in the Torah, to realize that that's our own personal curriculum. It's not as if there's just automatically something wrong with them or something wrong with the text. We have to notice our judgment and then reactivity and practice around that. And so instead, also, we're going to have great compassion. If we need to have compassion for ourselves, we practice also towards others. So what's going on here? A lot of people, the first thing that happens, there's a famine in the land. When Avram and Sarai leave their land, which I just have to briefly say, that's actually quite, what is Lech Lecha mean? God's voice appears to Avram. He's over in Ur Kasdim, way far away. I think it might be like modern day Iraq. He is told to go forth, go for yourself. Listen to the term, Lech Lecha. What does that mean? That's so beautiful. That's so amazing, right? Go for yourself. He has to leave everything he knows. But really, this is about his journey. This is going to be that Avram will change and grow into something. Like, we all always are changing, but this is a personal journey, one that's taken with intention, and he will greatly face many, not only obstacles, but what we call bechirot, right? The bechira point, a choice point, where you can either go this way in your behavior or this way. And hopefully you choose the path of life. Hopefully you choose the wholesome, wise path, right? That causes the least amount of harm and suffering to you and others. So this is constantly where Avram is. He's listening to the voice of God. It's time for you to get up and go. You must take this journey. He heads off with Sarai and Lot and all their people that come with them and animals and such. They get in the land. They end up in Eretz Canaan. And what happens? What's the first big stimuli, which could be quite traumatic? There's a famine in the land. Could you imagine? Okay, I'm supposed to come to this land. There's a famine now. I have to leave. So they head down to Egypt. And what happens? Okay, there's a lot of judgment here based on our commentators. So the first thing that happens is there's a moral dilemma for Avram. Okay, he knows it's a choice between two evils. Radak, one of our classic parshanim, rabbinical commentators, really expounds on this. Okay, so he has taught us that if Avram discloses the truth, that when he gets down in Egypt, that he is really married to Sarai. He understands in that culture around him, and maybe he just knew this also in the culture he grew up in and traveling in, that he would be killed, that husbands will be killed of women, that some other man with more power who is native to the land will kill him and take the wife. Okay, apparently that's the culture back then. This is the story we're being told. So he happens to be in Egypt. Who's the head of Egypt? It's Paro, right? Sarai, we're told, has physical beauty and youth to her. So if he discloses the truth, he'll be killed. And what will be the consequence of that behavior? His wife will be unprotected as a stranger in a strange land and an alien society, right? That obviously to him, he already senses has low morality, has different values. And she will assuredly be condemned to a life of shame and abuse. She will essentially be taken by other men and most likely raped. Who knows what will happen to her in the end. So that's his first Bechira point. That's his choice. Okay, do I tell the truth? Is truth the highest value here? Right? The other choice is if he lies, if he hides who he is, he closets himself and says, I'm her brother, right? She might end up being violated by some Egyptian who takes her as a wife, right? But at least they both would survive. So either way, this is horrible for Sarai. Okay, you have to leave a famine, you have to get food to survive, but know when you're going to go get food and another society that does this to women and men. Your choice is that you will be kidnapped and taken and you might survive, or you will, your husband won't. So this is the Bakira point. All right. And many commentators and even modern day ones have so much reactivity to this, right? And the biggest judgment is Avram should have trusted in God, that God would have taken care of this and should have told the truth and move forward. He should have never left Sarai's side. He never should have never put her in such a situation where she would either be abused and shamed and he would be killed, or that she would be raped and taken as Paro's wife, right? Okay, so I want us to just note first, like, the judgment there. We weren't living back then. We have no idea what that was like, what he went through. We have no idea what we would have done. I mean, to me, it seems like he chose the lesser evil. Nowhere ever do we see God instructing and telling our ancestors that they are to trust and not try to do things and take matters into their own hands. We are always supposed to take matters into our own hands with the consequences of that, and God assists. But never are we to be like that story where we're like on the top of the roof and there's a huge hurricane flood and we're like, you know, finally, you know, people are sent to save us. And we keep saying, no, 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 I'll trust in God. I'll trust in God. I'll trust in God. And then finally we pass away because we drown. And we say to God, when we arrive there, why didn't you save me? And God's like, I sent a person to help you. I sent a boat and I sent a helicopter. And you didn't take matters into your own hands. You didn't try to save yourself. Okay. So I'm just going to leave it at that, which is, compassion for Avram, compassion for Sarai. And trust me, I used to be one of those people that judged very harshly. I used to be very angry at Avram because his wife just basically had, I mean, she's already a second-class citizen because she's a woman. She doesn't really have 100% a self-ownership where she can really consent to things and have self-agency. So this is very hard and vulnerable, but it's about facing the reality of the world, where this, she's a woman in this very patriarchal world, and this is how she'll be treated. Okay. So that's the first personal trauma, right? The first personal experience. And then, okay. So as I said, she's the first recorded kidnapping. She's taken by Paro. God intervenes. I don't need to get into all the details. You can read the Torah portion. She is then sent free and they leave together. Sarai and Avram head back into Eretz Canaan with all their cattle. The next incident, he's heading up with Lot, his cousin, his nephew, depending on who you read. And they're having conflict because of a lack of amount of land to share the cattle. So Lot heads on his own way. And as I said, there happens to be this war from five kings to four kings. Lot is kidnapped and his whole family and taken captive up north. And this is quite extraordinary because we suddenly see fidelity and the strong connection to in this Jewish family to take care of each other, that you are to respond. You're not just to go, oh, that's so sad. You know, what can we do? instead, Avram organizes with his neighbors that he already seems to have a covenant with, and for the, maybe only for the concept of war, but we don't know. And they agree and head north with him. Many men, and they go to war to release the captives. They end up winning. This is extraordinary, okay? Because we also see, if I can find my text with you, we can see in this text a shift in Avram, right? You know, he's someone that we think is going to remain, you know, he's leaving to go on this spiritual journey. He's going to leave the land. And what does he have to do? He's a foreigner. He's a ger in a foreign land, and he has to go to war. That's significant. I want to talk about this just a tiny bit. You know, God has made these divine promises to Avram, and all of them seem like they're going to be miscarried because all these obstacles keep happening to Avram. The famine, what happens to Sarai, and then Lot leaving, and then the war, and then having to redeem the captive and coming down, right? This is all very intense, and you would think that it's not going to happen, right? So in the first biblical report of warfare, what do we witness? We witness new facets to Avram's character, to our ancestor, who, you know, obviously he had that Bahira point in Egypt and was evasive and didn't know how to act, but he knew he wanted to save his life. He wanted to do self-preservation. He did not want to die. He did not want to be killed. And now we have him showing he's very decisive. This is not a Bahira point for him. His nephew has been kidnapped, and that's it. When it doesn't concern him and his own life, which it might, he might be killed in battle. But it's about about saving Lot. He's very decisive, and he's courageous. He organizes and he heads up. This is very moral clarity of his moral compass. There's no Bahira point here, as we call in Musar practice, no choice point. And so he heads up. This is very self-sacrificing loyalty to his family member, part of his tribe. He's obviously a military hero, but he's not glorified as such. This is not the object of our people and in our Sefer Torah and in the Hebrew Bible. He's not the one to initiate the war. He's drawn into it, right? He responds. There's not reactivity here. The final thing I will say that none of the staple ingredients in any other kind of ancient Near East war story are here. It's not about being a chronicle for the war and who won what and what booty was exchanged and who died and who what. Instead, the whole story emphasizes the virtues of loyalty to family, the redeeming of captives, which is where we are today, and disdain for material reward. Avram will not take anything from the king of Sodom. He just says, please give to the other people who came to help me. And really, there's something very important there going on. Okay, so that's another stimuli which might be traumatic. The whole time this is happening of their journey from Ur Kasdim to Eretz Canaan down to Egypt, back up, Sarai is barren. She's not getting pregnant. Okay. This is huge. We see this family trauma moving into a communal one. It begins to begin, which is she can no longer stand it. Her bucket is getting full. So a woman, you have to understand back then, her whole purpose was to be a vessel to reproduce offspring for the husband. If she failed to do that, either because his sperm was not working or there was something with her body, she was seen as a failure in some sense, meaning she could be divorced, another woman could be brought in. There had to be a solution to the problem. He needed offspring. So she obviously felt that pressure, and some people see it as self-sacrifice what she does next in response to this, but I just want to give the context that she decides, which is common for women back then, to give her servant to her husband, and not just as a concubine. This is where she's actually quite honorable, and there's a lot of respect here. She has Hagar marry her husband, okay? a lot of people don't emphasize this, but this is quite significant. So she really wants to raise up the whole thing and have this offspring happen, right? So she gives the Hagar as a wife. Again, what does consent mean to women who are second class citizens and have no self agency? I don't think consent is here. I think she just has to follow what is given to her. So she ends up marrying Avram. She gets pregnant immediately. Okay. And there you might, if this is a kind, loving story where people, made wise choices and used wise speech, right speech, were kind to one another. We might have a story like Bilha and Zilpah to Rachel and Leah that they could reproduce children on behalf of the women that they're servant to, and that they could all just raise a family together. Of course, there would be, like any family, ups and downs, but that's not what happens here. When Hagar gets pregnant immediately, she becomes very unkind. She uses unwise speech. She uses judgment. She turns to her lady, who she is a servant to, Sarai, and Sarai is lowered in her eyes. She feels that she is now above and acts and treats as such this way to Sarai. And she's unkind to her. And in that society, that's not acceptable. There are many legal codes, like the Hammurabi, that talk about how to treat a servant who starts treating its owner that way. And so the first reactivity is Sarai's. She is totally triggered by this. It's her Bechira point. Like, could she just ignore this behavior and have the child and get through this, or is she going to react? And she unfortunately chooses reactivity. The same thing with Hagar. Could Hagar have just like had the child, and even if she felt that way about Sarai, not acted it out? And no, her Bechira point was unfortunately to choose ill will and greed and of that sort. Okay, so this is now moving into a larger family issue that will go on. So what is Sarai's reactivity? She ends up being cruel to Hagar. We don't know exactly what she did, but it seems like there might have been violence, so either physical beating or verbal or both. Avram submits to this, or consents to it, I should really say, because when he's approached, he just tells Sarai to do what you want with her. This triggers a lot of our commentators and people who, and maybe even yourself, who run into this story. They feel like Avram should have never consented to this and told Sarai not to behave this way and not to do what she wants with her. So it unfolds. This unfolds into a familial trauma that will turn into a communal one. So what happens? Sarai runs away. No, sorry. Hagar runs away. They're both kind of running away in some ways. And, you'll read the story as it unfolds. She does return, ends up having a son and Yishmael, and moves onward from there. Okay. I think that's all I want to touch on, because I want to get into some what are we to learn from all this, right? Which is the commentators will come and place a lot of judgment, as I said, on mostly on Sarai and then on Avram for their behavior, from being deeply triggered and all of the activity that's happened to them. And they try to learn something from this. They feel like maybe the Torah is trying to teach something. So they wonder, for instance, Nechama Leibowitz, in her studies on Bereshit and Genesis, on page 156, and I quote, "Perhaps the Torah wished to teach us that before man undertakes a mission that will tax all his moral and spiritual powers, he should ask himself first whether he can maintain those same high standards to the bitter end. So she's applying this, for instance, to Sarai's behavior that she shouldn't have been so self-sacrificing. She shouldn't have given Hagar as a wife to reproduce a child because she couldn't really handle the consequences of it, however they unfold. I take issue with that. First of all, I don't think Sarai had much power or choice in this. This was what a woman had to do. She was barren or she ends up being divorced. Yeah, I just feel like this is not so helpful at all. And it also gives way too much agency to Sarai. And then we could even look at our own lives. How many of us can be aware in the moment of such difficult stimuli or trauma of when we are being taxed to the point where our moral and spiritual powers are completely deleted, that we could actually pause with mindfulness, a practice, and ask ourselves whether we can maintain the standards to the bitter end? How many of us enter these situations being able to have that space to question that? We don't. Like, even though I have a daily practice, I've been practicing for over 22 years, right? And even longer with mindfulness meditation since 1996. I practice so that I can handle whatever is thrown at me in life, right? But sometimes there are going to be triggers that are so trying, so difficult. They are suffering in and of themselves, regardless of my reactivity. And like, for instance, that this genocide on October 7th is one of them, and the ongoing of our people being kidnapped and not returned home. It's taxing all of our moral and spiritual powers. And there's no way we could have said and paused beforehand and said, am I going to be able to maintain my high standards to the bitter end? Well, no, we couldn't pause before the terrorists arrived and question, can we handle this? Can we get through this? What's being handed to us? No. So instead of all this judgments, both to our ancestors and even to ourselves, right? The whole world. And I wouldn't say there's the world right now feels deeply divided. It has for a long time among many people. But in the world of this war right now and of the genocide, you seem to have those who have a lot of judgments towards the people Israel and the land Israel, as if we have not lived up to our moral and spiritual powers and standards. And it's really their standards. And then you have this side of the world who is completely supporting Israel and the people Israel in response to this, and believes in, you know, wise, appropriate consequence for a people invading and entering a land and murdering and torturing and raping and kidnapping. There has to be a response. And so what we need to learn from this, I feel like, if anything, from this that Hashem has handed us, essentially, is that a lot of people out there need to check themselves. They need to check that they are projecting onto us and the people Israel, and we might even be internalizing it on some level. We have to be very careful to lay boundaries, right? That we don't let somebody else's moral and spiritual high standards be projected onto us when they're actually not here living it. Okay. And that's the first thing that we can learn out from this, right? The other thing I want to say to you is this is so much a practice in self-compassion. It has to be. We're going to actually move into a mindfulness meditation practice around this together. But there's a story coming out of the Dharma where it's one of my favorite stories, actually, where we talk about that there are gatekeepers at the gate because, you know, there used to be very much walled cities. We still have some here in the Middle East. And they would be gatekeepers at the gate, and they would have to assess who to let in, who would be life-affirming and safe for the community to let in, and who's not. And the story is meant to be a direction and a metaphor for our own internal gate, our own internal wall city. We are not to just let in everything. We have to learn discernment, very wise discernment of what we're going to let in. It has to be life affirming. It has to be something safe, something that cares about our dignity as created in the image and likeness of the divine. And only take in those and accept those into our gated soul, our gated temple, our gated experience of life. And be very clear to not let in the other, because right now we have many enemies who are trying to harm us, who are not seeing us as equal citizens with agency, as someone who is created in the image and likeness of the divine. And we have to lay boundaries and not take in those, that treatment and that image. Okay. So we're going to move into our mindfulness meditation practice, but I want all of us to begin this practice really asking yourself, what is my lech lecha, right? What do I need to go for myself? What do I need? Where do I need to change and grow like Avram had to go through? So obviously this is one of our trials, nisayon, right? One of our experiences that are going to deeply shape us. And may we, along the path, make the most life-affirming, wise decisions that are supportive of us on the soul level and supportive of our people and community. We will make mistakes along the way. Why? Because we're human. We're human. And part of this practice, obviously, is to know that you are not alone. This is about shared humanity. First of all, your people, Am Yisrael, from in Haaretz in Israel and the whole world, everyone is suffering. You are not alone. You're being carried by everyone. And then there's just the common humanity element that across the world, everyone is dealing with their own little pain and suffering, that everyone goes through something like this. Obviously not every people goes through, or even personal individuals goes through, being murdered and raped and tortured and kidnapped, but every person throughout their life will have some form of pain and suffering. It might just be from illness. It might be from loss of loved ones. The regular healthy life that wasn't having terrorists and just unhealthy sick people come in to cause harm and suffering. Okay. So we have the element that we need to be with what is. We have to come into practice together and just sit with what is. See if we can do that. We might not be ready. It might be way too overwhelming. And it's okay. Wherever you are, you will be seen and accepted. So being seen, if you can be here with what is, that's our first level of practice. The second is the common humanity that we all share. On some level, the suffering or no suffering. And the third is a real deep practice in self-compassion. We have to take care of ourselves so then we can have compassion towards others, rachamim. This comes from Kristen Neff's work on self-compassion. And so we're going to move into our meditation practice right now. I want you to assume one of the four postures that we classically do in mindfulness meditation, whether it's seated, walking back and forth, standing in a strong pose, maybe holding onto a chair, or lying down. If you lie down, please keep your eyes open. If you obviously keep your eyes open, if you're walking and maybe even standing, you can lower your gaze so you block out visual stimulation so that you can turn inward to whatever your inward experience is. If you're seated like me, you want to really be a little bit forward on the chair so that you're not lying back and getting relaxed, right? Because we need to be awake and alert and at ease, okay? So I come to the edge of the chair. I really plant my seat bones. Very important to really feel held by the chair. And I begin to close my eyes. You're welcome to do so if you feel safe. I plant my feet in the ground, feeling Mother Earth hold me, right? And if at any point during this practice together, you feel overwhelmed or not safe, open your eyes, plant it on something safe, look around the room, know that you are safe, that you are here. And you join me with a deep inhalation and exhalation and inhalation and exhalation. This last one, raise your shoulders up, inhalation and exhalation. I don't think it was by accident or just coincidence that we were celebrating as a people the holiday of Shemini Atzeret and Simcha Torah, which means the great joy of Torah, when this genocide began. And what do I mean by that? It is in our deepest practice as the people of appreciative joy, of really resourcing ourselves. We really know how to share the ups and downs. And particularly, this was the up of the most joyful holiday of Sukkot, 7 days here in Israel of dwelling in the sukkah, in the booth, sharing meals with family and friends, really understanding how we resource ourselves and support one another in this joy. That practice, which is consistent in our calendar, allows us to be able to turn towards the suffering that arises, one from this genocide on October 7th, on the Eshkol celebration of Simchat Torah, with an attitude of compassion. So that joy, when we really have this heart of chesed, of loving kindness, of metta, with a sense of friendliness and availability that we opened our booths and homes to others, right? It really is uplifting and it's inspiring. And compassion arises from this heart of kindness, a heart with enough friendliness and availability, right? And that allows us to face suffering when we encounter pain. And I really feel that that's part of why we are able to so resource and turn to one another and care for one another. I was deeply moved by a young teenage girl who survived the genocide from one of the kibbutzim next to Gaza. And she was smiling at the end of the interview. She was in the hospital with her father who had been harmed and injured by the terrorists. And she was smiling. And you need to understand that her mother and her brother had been murdered by the Palestinian terrorists. And she was smiling. And the person said, how can you be smiling right now? And she said, my mother and my brother want us to be happy. They would want us to be happy. So she obviously grew up in a culture and family unit where there was appreciative joy, an understanding of the root of life, of sharing those moments. And she was able to use that as a resource in her deepest pain and most trying moment. And that's what we're going to explore in this unit, in this meditation right now. When life is so hard, how can we be anything but kind? That's where our aim is. That's where our practice is. Amidst this great difficulty and pain, what calls for is kindness and compassion, as the wise response. So allowing yourself to fully settle in this meditation as you follow my voice. Coming to stillness. Developing and exploring the ways that we will orient our compassion internally. Really drawing on the insights of Kristen Neff and Chris Skirmer, the three dimensions of self-compassion. Number one, the recognition and acknowledgement of the suffering that all of us experience right now, what you are experiencing personally. And as I said, if it's too much, if it's too hard to acknowledge and recognize, then just honor that. Say, I can't be with all of it right now. That's okay. Number two is recognizing this universal nature of suffering. It is part of our common humanity. We are not alone. This is something that actually unites us. Number three is practicing the intention to meet this suffering with kindness and compassion. And as we settle into this practice right now, finding a posture that feels supportive, that feels relatively comfortable, that feels grounding. Settling into the sense of the body, sitting or standing or lying here. Walking here, if you're doing the walking meditation. Feeling the sensitivity of this body, the way in which it is indeed impinged upon by life. Settling into the sensitivity of this body. Feeling how that sensitivity can be sorted by a sense of grounding, of really valuing the contact, which is steadying, the anchors of the body that give a sense of support and okayness. The feet on the floor, the seat on the chair, the hands resting in the lap. Sometimes the most compassionate response to our suffering is simply to move between the hands resting in the lap and the simple movements of breathing, meaning bring your attention to your hands on your lap, inhalation. Exhalation, bring your attention to your breath. Letting these anchors be places that you can return to, places of steadying, of resourcing, places from which we can be open to feel the sensitivity of this body and heart, to feel the tenderness that is impinged upon by life. And it may be that in this moment, there is difficulty. There is pain in the body or in the heart mind. Allow yourself to see if it's possible just to allow and breathe with that. And you might wish simply to practice with what's already here during the rest of this practice. If you notice that your body and heart mind feel relatively okay, relatively resourced in this moment, see if you can bring the difficulty in your life to your mind right now. Something that is manageable. Something that is not overwhelming. Staying in contact with the ground, the anchors of the body, opening to the presence of that which is so difficult right now. remembering its effect on the body and the heart. Allow yourself to feel what you can. Even calmly saying, this hurts. This is what it feels like to have a broken heart. This is what it feels like to be fearful. This is what it feels like to be in pain. Noticing the contraction, the tightening, any change to tone and texture of the body, mood and feeling of the mind and heart. Breathing with this. Seeing if we can allow this. You may wish to gently place your hand on your heart as I have, or on your belly, or some other part of the body that's in pain, just as a support, an attitude of care, of compassion, of kindness. We are recognizing the presence of suffering. This is suffering. This is difficult. This hurts. Allow yourself to say these quietly outside to yourself, whatever you need to feel and breathe, allowing this to be present. If anything feels too much, too overwhelming, take your attention to the place of support and anchoring, the feet, the seat, the hands, the breathing. Places of steadying in the midst of this difficulty. The invitation now is to recognize that other people experience this, even in this moment. Our stories may be different. The sense, the flavor of suffering may be different or similar. The suffering connects us with others, even if at times we feel very alone in the midst of it. Other people are experiencing this. Suffering and vulnerability are something that unite us, that connect us. Remembering this can be a support in the face of when we feel contractions and constrictions, where we are in that narrow space. We say in our psalms from that narrow place, I call, I cry out to you, God. Now bringing care and kindness to your suffering. This is the third step in the practice, to embody the intention to relate with self-compassion. You are deserving of love and compassion. You are created in the image and likeness of the divine. Hashem wants you to care for yourself. You have been entrusted with a soul. You are the temple. You may kindly whisper to yourself, I care about the suffering. May I hold the suffering with compassion. May I hold the suffering with kindness. Breathing in kindness. Breathing out compassion. Just like you would to your most beloved, your best friend. You would be so kind and compassionate towards them and their suffering. That is how you are to treat yourself. You are developing your own best friendship with yourself. Sensing to the extent that feels possible, the meeting of the suffering and the moment with an attitude of care, of tenderness, of compassion. It is so important in this practice to keep sensing what resources us. The grounding of the feet, the sit bones grounded in the chair, the awareness of the hands on the heart or lap, the awareness of the breath, the awareness that we are taking refuge in community, that we're sharing this breath and oxygen, this gift from God together. You are not alone. A sense of uprightness, a sense of grounding, a sense of nourishment, of breathing and being in this practice together. Taking refuge in the path, taking refuge in God. We thank our ancestors and God for these teachings, for these lessons, to know how to pivot, to know how to resource and care for ourselves and others. And then it may be as you sit here that this feels enough for now. You may wish to end this practice by letting your hands return to your lap and coming back to a sense of grounding of the body. Maybe bringing to mind something that you're grateful for in this moment, resourcing yourself in this way, in this difficulty that we are facing right now in this life. Some of you may wish to continue to sit for a while in touch with the sense of the suffering and the sense of common humanity. Ending the practice or continuing in a way that feels appropriate to you. In touch with your deepest divine inner compass and motivation. For you to care for yourself and others, to bring God's good to others and to yourself. I bow to God. I bow, and I'm so grateful for our practice and taking refuge together and being here. I thank you. Please do provide comments and write to us. Let us know how this practice was for you, if it was life-affirming, it's what you need in this moment, how we can be of service, what else we can offer. As this is our weekly public offering of awakening, Torah, Musar, mindfulness, one on the path of resourcing in our grief and loss and healing. One day at a time. Thank you. God bless for today.